Hey everyone, Greg Wells here. Just wanted to take a moment and let you know that we have an app. During lockdown, when everything sort of shut down, we put all our efforts and energies at Wells Performance into digital because we had to. Clearly, I wasn't doing any public speaking around the world, so things needed to change. So we took something that we'd been working on for about 3 years sort of in the background and brought it to the like urgent forefront of what we were doing. And we put all our efforts and energies into finishing our app. So I've had a number of PhDs working on this for many years. I've got Ming Cheng Tsai doing data analytics, Jessica Caterini doing the medical side of things, Evan Lewis doing the work on nutrition. I've been doing some stuff on sleep, and Sarah Thompson's been working on the kinesiology side of things. And we have built this app. We call it Vivio, V-I-I-V-I-O. That's Latin for life. The website's viiv.io, so Vivio. And we built an app that tracks your sleep, nutrition, exercise, and mindset using all the latest tools and technologies that are available in iOS and Apple Watch. So it's built currently for Apple Watch and iPhone. It basically allows you to track your sleep, track your nutrition, track your exercise, track your mindset. And then we built an algorithm that gives you individualized recommendations based on your own results. I basically built an app that I wanted to have that had everything in one place. So I don't have to have just my, you know, my workout tracker and then my sleep tracker. And like, it's all over the place. We built one that has everything in one location. We used the latest research to build the scoring mechanisms. We score actually every single one of those areas. Eat, Sleep, Move, Things gets a score out of 10 on a daily basis to give you a sense of how you're doing against the latest research and the top thinking. So we're pretty excited about it. It's definitely for biohackers. It's definitely for people that are really interested in, you know, pushing the limits on their health and well-being and performance, which is probably you if you're listening to this podcast. Introductory, the basic version's free, so you can check it out. Absolutely free. There's no cost. The pro version gets you the daily tips and access to your history if you want to see how you're doing and improving. So if you want to check it out, you can do so. No cost. If you want to get the pro version, we would be infinitely grateful and just so privileged to have your support on that. So check it out, viiv.io. It's Vivio. We'd love to hear what you think of our new app that we built during lockdown. All right. Hope you're good. And please enjoy this episode. Thanks for listening. Welcome back. It's great to be with you. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode of my podcast. I'm Dr. Greg Wells, and each week I do my best to interview athletes, scientists, adventurers, experts in fields related to health, well-being, and high performance. And this week I wanted to get a little bit nerdy. I wanted to get back into physiology. I wanted to get back into training. And I've been trying to run a lot more lately. Therefore, I thought it would be cool to talk to a runner. And so looked around through the network and was really excited that Sasha Gaulish was available to chat. Sasha is an assistant professor in engineering at the University of Toronto. Obviously, he's a professional engineer, but is also a world-class international runner. And so the fact that she combines both rigorous academics and teaching, especially where she really loves to focus her efforts, and also high-performance sport is pretty inspiring, given that that's quite a bit of, you know, my background and my history of trying to combine those two areas as well. Sash and I, in this conversation, get into the nuances of training. We get into some of the data analysis that you can do and how to look at yourself as an athlete. And this doesn't mean that you have to be an international-level athlete. You can apply this to anything. The fact that we're all wearing devices these days that track our steps, our sleep, even sometimes our nutrition, our stress levels, we can all learn so much more about ourselves using wearable technology. The data that we have access to about ourselves has never been greater. And so I thought that, you know, thinking about it from an engineering perspective and engineering yourself, I thought would be kind of cool, which is exactly what we're going to do this week. So please enjoy my deep dive into the science of engineering your own excellence with my friend and data geek and, you know, training nerd, Sasha Gaulish. Sasha, thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm catching you up at your cottage. What does life look like for you right now? Like, what's going on?
It's beautiful. Stop, embrace the moment of joy. It's beautiful. It's snowing directly north of me. I can see the snow falling on Christian Island.
Oh.
Yeah. the reds are gone on the trees, but the yellows are still here. There's a big group of clouds. There's a big storm coming. There's a big group of clouds moving overhead. But I'm in a pretty magical spot. I mean, I think there's magic in the trees and in the water. And I feel very privileged and very blessed to be in such a magical spot. So yeah, that's my view.
Amazing. That's so cool. And what is like professionally life look like for you right now? We're doing engineering, we're doing running. Like, what's your scope of life practice at the moment on a day-to-day basis?
Don't forget trying to bake something at least once a day.
Yeah, and training a puppy too.
Yeah, and training the puppy. So sometimes I'll bake for the puppy. I'm like, ooh, what can I make you? So it's a balance of, I'm an assistant professor teaching STREAM in the Engineering Communication Program Office, which is part of the Faculty of Applied Science and Engineering in ISTEP, which stands for the Institute for Studies in Transdisciplinary Engineering Education and Practice. Woo, got
wow.
it. Yeah. So I am currently teaching across, so I don't have my own course, but I'm in one of 15 courses. I think I compare myself to Hermione Granger between 12 and 3 on Tuesdays because I can be in anywhere of 4 places. So right. The remote guarantee world's a little bit better because I'm like, oh, hang on, I'm just going to pause and jump here. And then running, put my shoes on, walk out the door. And I've kind of got 20 kilometers just outside my cottage door without having to go up a massive hill. And people at either end of that, should I get into any trouble, who can come rescue me?
That's awesome. How did you get into running? Like, take me back to the beginning. Like, how did this become a passion for you?
Oh, it's my favorite person in the world. My mom. So I have a brother that's 12 years younger than me. And so 2 years before my brother was born, my mom asked if I would do the inaugural CIBC Breast Cancer Run for the Cure. And I was like, oh my gosh, of course I'll do that with you. And I had started running cross country that fall. I went to Crestwood because I was a serious problem child. Not serious, but like funny story. But anyways, so I had started cross country and my mom was like, okay, you set the pace. I'll keep up. And I was 10 and I think we ran 1956. And so my mom.
Oh my God.
Yeah, well, there was people winning and I was like, I'm going to win this race. I mean, I think I was broken for days.
Yeah.
My mom broke 20 minutes, but that was my intro to running. And so my mom's busy schedule, she'd every so often get home from work early, throw her shoes on and be like, you want to come? I'd be like, yeah, I do. So yeah.
Very, very cool. And what was it about it that like fascinated you or like caught your attention or fueled that passion? Was it like the feeling of running? Was it pushing your body? Was it going into your body? Was it like what was it that sort of made it something that you just like loved to do?
Okay, so I really wanted to be a professional alpine ski racer, but wow. Obviously, when you look at me, probably not going to happen. So,
a few too many type 1 muscle fibers, perhaps? Or
huge. I mean, my downhill suit would like blow in the wind behind me.
Yeah.
I used to fill the arms because I never could get the arms to fit because it was just too skinny. So, I became a pretty good skier and I was very passionate about it and loved it, but running I was good at. And maybe it's just a confidence booster. Like I was tiny. I kind of did well at school, but was sort of didn't really want to play that card. Like I was like, whatever, school, great, funny, I have a PhD now. But I think it gave me the confidence to pursue other things. And then it just became a community where I felt I belonged.
Yeah. You said you were a problem child. How did running help with that? Like tell you were like funny story. Like, what is that funny story? Like, how did that play out? I'm curious.
In grade 3, just be like, I didn't think you were confident. I walked up to my teacher and I was like, poetry is stupid. I'm not doing this. It's not going to help me get a job. It's not addition and subtraction. I'm not doing this. And back then, I think there were 38 kids in our public school classroom. And like, I was just a defiant child. And if I wasn't going to do something, I really wasn't going to do something. And so I would, during poetry, go find like a grade 5, grade 6 math textbook, open it up and play with it. So, you know, I recognize what a privileged lifestyle I have and grew up in. And my parents sent me to private school where someone made me not do poetry because I still thought it was stupid, but got me to see the benefits of understanding how to spell and how to read and reading comprehension and creating creative writing and writing. And I think, you know, I look back now, I'm like, whoo, thank goodness, because writing really is so important in life. But also then that teacher said, okay, I'll trade you, right? Like it was a risk reward. Like I'll trade you. You could have a grade 7 math textbook, but first you have to do this. But she still promised me no poetry. So I'm terrible at poetry to this day. I don't even have an appreciation for it. I have an appreciation for people who do it. I don't particularly like it. Love to read, but just poetry's never been my jam.
Got it. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And you went on to get a PhD. Like how did... And you sort of threw that out there, like, oh, I ended up with a doctorate, which is kind of funny. It's like, I was certainly not academic when I was younger either, but landed somehow with a PhD as well. So that's why I kind of latched onto that. I'm like, that's kind of curious. How did that happen?
Okay. So I started my PhD so I could run for the University of Toronto. Like, okay. Not joking. Carl was like, do a PhD and you can join the track team again. I was like, that's a great idea. But in high school, I didn't want to actually go to university. I wanted to become a pro runner coming out of high school. And I was like, I don't need to go to school. I'll figure this out. I'll be a ski tech rep. And my parents said, well, you'll actually benefit. Like your running will benefit by going to the University of Toronto. Your coach is there. There's no professional programs here like there are in the US. Like just go. And so I went into commerce and hated it and didn't do very well, probably because I didn't really like it. And by second year, figured out that engineering was pretty cool and I should be there. So I should kind of rewind a second. When I was in grade 13, so OAC, because I am that old, my brother broke his femur. So my brother, who's 12 years younger than me, broke his femur in the schoolyard and my parents were away. That happened to coincide with start picking stuff to go to university and meeting with your guidance counselor. So missed all that. Literally ticked off the box for arts and science and commerce because I was like, people make money in banking, so I'll go do that.
Yeah.
Foolish. But yeah, so that's how I ended up in commerce. And then someone on the track team was like, you're pretty into science and math. Like, have you ever thought of engineering? And then that's when my eyes opened up to it and how I ended up in engineering. And then sort of fast forward my master's, I was working at the Ministry of Transportation of Ontario. And my first year review was, you're doing too much and you make other people feel bad about themselves. And I was like, oh, wow, really? This is my review? Okay, great. I was like, how about I pick up a master's and I'll do less work here and more work overall? And they were like, yeah, we're willing to pay for that. So that's how I ended up in my master's.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Just a desire. I don't know if it's to be productive, but I think I have a voracious thirst for knowledge. And I think that's probably why I ended up in my master's. And I mean, it was U of T because it was subway accessible from the Ministry of Transportation.
That's super interesting. And just out of curiosity, what did you do your PhD on?
My PhD is in engineering education. So I looked at the connection of mathematics to engineering.
Do you use your engineering and mathematics for your running?
Oh my gosh, all the time. So I really, okay. So the real PhD I wanted to do was bringing coaching principles to the mathematics classroom in engineering. And when I went into my meeting to get funding, they're like, we don't have a problem in our mathematics classroom. It's like, of course you do. But, you know, as NASA says, in God we trust, all others must bring data. And I was like, well, I guess it's time I go get the data.
Yep.
So yes, there is an issue, but there was lots in terms of like the motivation, the resilience, the connecting what you're doing personally and professionally, creating an argument that, one, I sorted all of it out while running. And two, I think it made me a better runner too.
Mm-hmm. How did you sort it out while running? Like what goes on in your brain that enables you while running to solve these problems?
I think it's just the ability to step away and reflect, right? So you're like, okay, so ADD. Ooh, squirrel. Ooh, solved
yeah.
that problem.
Yeah, totally. I asked actually because I was out, we were climbing Chimborazo in Ecuador about 5 years ago and we were on a training day and it was pouring rain. I had all my Gore-Tex on. We were walking around the volcano for like 6-7 hours up and down, just like a pure training to get used to altitude. And I was staring into the back of one of the people who was there with us, heard the back of her head And we were actually working on an MRI problem at the time. We couldn't figure out why our MRI data was reading, you know, certain things. So it was basically complex physics, which I was able to do in my head while walking around the base of this volcano, because I was in this rhythmic, repetitive movement pattern, and I could actually think for 6 hours. And it was really cool that, and I'm not good at physics, let's be absolutely clear about that one, like this is not my strength, but I was able to do it that day. And I was like, actually, I think I solved this problem, sir. I think I know what's going on. And it was just crazy that it happened. Like, it was cold, it was wet, it was rainy, it was windy, it was uncomfortable, it was super hypoxic, and I could do physics in my head because I was doing rhythmic, repetitive movements, and I sorted it out. So I'm, anyway.
But you couldn't write it down at the time because your hands were so cold.
Yeah, exactly. And I lost it because I forgot about it afterwards and couldn't write it down. No, I'm just kidding. We actually did figure it out and ended up publishing it. But that's so when you said like you sorted it out while running, I was like, oh my gosh, that happened to me too. That makes total sense.
And you're almost right. Like you don't want to tell that story, right? Because it's this idea that you have to sit and stare at the data all the time and your screen and what's going on, and that stepping away from something is almost wrong. But everything in the research tells us that it's right, right? I can't remember what, it's a physicist, I think, who would hold a marble in their hand. And as they were falling asleep, right? Like that's pretty magical time too, right? Like the notebook beside, everybody has to have a notebook beside their bed, but they'd have a marble in their hand so that the marble would hit the floor and wake them up. And they'd be able to work through that. Like, I don't know, it's not zoned out, but like that non-automatic response, but automatic response thinking. Feynman used to do it. Feynman used to get in the float tank, the deprivation tank, and sort through all of his physics problems. He was definitely good at physics.
Yeah, a little bit different. I hadn't actually heard about Feynman, but I have heard about that marble story. And I think that right before you fall asleep, you're in a brainwave state called theta brainwave states, where you are creative, you can problem solve, you can think in an agile manner. But it's literally right above sleep in terms of your activation level. So that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. I don't, when I'm falling asleep, because I love sleeping. It's a magic healing power. I don't sleep with a marble, but sometimes napping, I'll wake myself up. Because even if it's like if the short 20-minute nap and getting to that state, like you kind of feel just as refreshed. And then at least you've got the problem sorted out so that you're like, oh, yes, tackled that.
So that's kind of cool that you use running to help you in your profession, help you to do your engineering, help you to do mathematics. Engineering also maybe helps you to run. I'd love to learn more, just like you as a scientist and as like a mathematician, how did you ping it and send it in the other direction? Like how did you use engineering for better sports performance?
I mean, I start with civil engineering. So like draw your free body diagram and think about your foot going into the ground and equal and opposite reaction. So I think one of the first things that I ever played with was A's and B's. And it's I actually ran an unofficial track club up at the cottage this summer. And this very endearing six-year-old said to me, you're really good at drills. You must have been practicing these for a really long time. And yeah, so, you know, going back to slowing things down. So I think, you know, when I was pursuing alpine skiing and working through the levels, someone reminded me that when you're doing things fast, you can kind of cheat and you can let gravity and speed get you out of a sticky situation. But when you really slow things down, you got to go back to basics. And I was like, okay, so if I want to maximize my, you know, ground stroke force and my efficiency, I have to go back to the basics with drills. And two things help. One, video. I actually am pretty good at processing things when people say, hey, you're doing this, and can visualize it. But I think there's just something to be said by seeing yourself on video. And Chris Shepherd, who he's out of the Runners Academy in Toronto. Just, you know, one of the things that I didn't think about was overstriding. So when you think about trying to go faster, the first thing that you usually do, particularly on a treadmill, is lengthen your stride as opposed to picking up your cadence. And it's for sure a blend of the two. But the first thing that you need to retrain your brain to do is to pick up the cadence. So, you know, my science brain is like, always employ the expert because they know better than you, steal their superpower, learn from the best, and then make it simple enough and easy enough. Like it's also got to be easy enough that you can employ in your practice. Otherwise you're not going to do it. And then make it easy enough that you can do it. And I think drills, you know, Ministry of Silly Walks, had someone stop me this summer, be like, oh my gosh, are you injured? I was like, no, I'm just doing my drills. Obviously I look Like,
that's awesome. Are you okay? Actually, no, I'm just practicing. That's I'm okay.
And they were like, oh, actually, all that makes sense now. Sorry. I was like, yeah, it's okay. It's a good laugh. But, you know, practicing the ministry of silly walks outside of your house, like, you never know who is a runner and whose running you might change for the better because you are willing to be vulnerable and kind of do something that makes you feel awkward and uncomfortable. And then share the knowledge with someone else. So lots of ministry of silly walks outside my front door in Toronto.
I love it. You mentioned superpower a bunch in various different ways and like learning from others and, you know, using your superpower. Like you've said that 3 or 4 times in a whole bunch of different contexts. Is that something that you think about a lot? Like, is that just, or because it seems to be sort of a pervasive thing and it seems to be like a like related sometimes to engineering, sometimes to running, sometimes to like influences from other people. Like, I'm curious what that means to you or why that keeps coming up.
So it comes from my partner, Raul. So when we first started dating, he's like, I want to steal that superpower from you. And I was like, well, that's very mean. Like, why would you take that away from me? And he's like, no, hold on. He's like, stealing someone's superpower is embodying something that you admire about them. So a strength or something they could do. And he's like, your ability to climb up hills on a bicycle, I would like to steal. He's like, you're like a soap bar. We start going up a hill and it's like, boom, you slide away from me and go away. And I'm like, I'm little, I go up hills well. But saying it out loud, because it's actually a compliment to someone else. Like, hey, how did you learn how to do this? I'm really curious because I'd like to get better at that in my life, which creates connection, helps you work on your weaknesses. And I like the idea of a superpower because I think that we're all like superheroes in our own ways every day. And like every so often, you have to put your superhero costume on to get out the door. But if you can be your own superhero, like I think it just makes life so much more fun.
I love it. What's your superpower?
Sleeping.
Really? So talk to me about that because I talk about sleep way too much. So I'm curious that you said that.
I know, I need your new book. I've read your other book. So like, I love to sleep. So when I was a toddler and my parents were young physicians and they had my sister who was a baby, I used to lie in my bed and yell, somebody come get me. I'm ready to get up now and put myself back to sleep. So I would sleep like 14, 16 hours as a 2-year-old.
Oh my gosh. And
I can still do that. Not that I have like, it's a habit, right? It's not a forced habit. Like it's my favorite habit. So crawling into bed at night with a good piece of fiction and falling asleep into that dream state. Like I love it. Like there's nothing, like I just love it. And then you wake up in the morning and you're like, yeah, can I swear on this podcast?
Oh, you absolutely can.
Get shit done. But that's a great way to wake up every day, right? Like, I'm so excited to get up. And when you start living your life that way, people are like, I can't believe how much you sleep and how much you get done. It's like, do you have any idea how much more productive you are when you sleep and you put your phone away?
Yeah. Imagine if you could, like, struggling through the day, exhausted, just sort of getting through versus trying to do the same thing in a completely rested state, how different your life would be.
Oh, totally. And every so often, like I do something silly and I don't sleep. Like I read a book that scares the crap out of me and I'm like, oh, no, I can't sleep. And then I obviously switch books because that doesn't work for anybody.
Yeah.
But you have to try that. And I think, you know, the commitment to good sleep habits, clean sleep, not sleeping with your phone, not sleeping with distractions, closing screens, reading, like, there's this fascination now with falling asleep to podcasts, and I don't have the research, but to me, we know the research says that if your phone is in your room, there's a draw to your phone and it's an increased stress. Like, find some other way to listen to a story time podcast to fall asleep that doesn't have your phone in the room. And you have to do it for 6 weeks because 3 weeks, it's like, ooh, you've kind of hit the like magic spot. It's like running, right? Mm-hmm. If you've ever start running, right? The first 3 weeks are horrific. Like they're the worst. Like even when I come back from training, I'm like, this is the worst time in my life. Why do I do this? And then on one day you're like, oh my gosh, this is the best thing in the world. And I think the same thing happens with sleep. But, you know, so I'm obsessed with Brené Brown's research, and we wear busyness as a badge of honor. That is not going away. And I think we had hoped in COVID, people would be like, oh my gosh, like resting is important, but I'm not sure that as many people as we thought have actually embraced that.
I agree. I'm really curious what you said about the 3-week window to feeling better. So this summer I spent a lot of time swimming and paddling. That's my easy spot. I'm a swimmer, right? So I love being in the water, but now it's colder. So I got started to run again. And you're right. The first 3 weeks was absolutely awful. The act of moving myself forwards was in and of itself like a war inside my brain and body. And then about 2 weeks ago, I went for a run. I was like, oh, wait a second. The act of running itself is no longer excruciating. This actually feels really good. And I was able to now basically go like I can run easy indefinitely. So it's kind of cool, but I'm curious what happens in that space. Cause like a lot of people on this list who listen to the show are trying to make improvements in their life, but the initial improvements usually result in you feeling worse before you feel better. So that really kind of triggered me to be like, I want to know more about that. So what are your thoughts there?
I think efficiency really like strikes me as like the number one, like your body goes through this like design cycle. Here are my engineering hats on. And it goes from, you know, design for movement, just move forward in any which way possible. And then it figures out what its own efficiencies are. And, you know, when you come back from injury or when you switch from like paddling and swimming back to running, you know, there's your body has to readjust to its new self and its new skin and muscles and the way the tendons are. And I think there's this efficiency, but I also think there's probably like some underlying thing that's like reward hard work and reward grit and reward determination. And if you're only really willing to stick with something for a week, you don't necessarily get those rewards, but if you can stick with it for that 3 to 4 weeks, right? It's a challenge and you can overcome that challenge, then you get to reap the rewards.
What comes after? Like, let's say you keep going. And what I'm expecting any time now is to rediscover that there's another gear. Cause I know that that's the next thing that comes is once you get going, you can run or do anything and it's easy. Then you discover that you can actually change speeds and that too is possible. And so putting your engineering design hat on, what's the progression look like beyond after you sort of got yourself into rhythm, the habit is installed, what then?
Well, so the one thing that I love from like morning glory, early morning rides is it never gets easier. You just get faster.
Yeah.
But the only way that you can get faster is exactly what you said, is pushing yourself. And so if your goal is to find running to be easy and efficient, you get there in like 3 to 4 weeks and it's lovely and it's fine. To find that next gear is another phase of discomfort. And so one of the things I try to think about, like when I put my coaching hat on, is getting, and I do this myself too, as an like coaching myself. Like, yes, I have a coach, but sometimes you're just out there and you have to coach yourself, is dissociating pain with something different and something uncomfortable. And so if you want to get faster and find that efficiency again, it's going to feel different and uncomfortable. And it's easier to work through that when you dissociate it with pain. Having said that, when you feel some orthopedic pain, please stop immediately. As my doctor dad said to me once, oh, does that hurt? Don't do it.
Yeah, I like that. And I want to dig into a little bit further. Obviously, yes, if it's an orthopedic injury, you've broken something, yes, stop. If you've sprained something, stop. So we'll leave that and be like, yes, that is true. But I want to know more about dissociating yourself from pain, and that discomfort and a feeling that is different is actually quite good and stimulates positive adaptation. But we often perceive that as pain and maybe think of it as a bad thing, but by dissociating ourselves from it, you can keep going. I want to know your thoughts on that. And perhaps you can tell us about the Berlin Marathon, because that might be an appropriate way to dig into this dissociation from pain thing.
Yeah, that really hurt at the end, though. I was really... So I took this great class in 2015 with Dr. Robin Sachs at U of T called Positive Psychology for Engineers, aka The Happy Engineer. And it was all about reframing and how you can reframe any situation. And I was like, oh, let's apply that to running, because when you get to the end of a really hard workout where your muscles are screaming at you, like It feels pretty awful. Feels real good after, though. Those endorphins are so worth it. But this reframing of, okay, and especially in those, like, for lack of a better word, lactic-y workouts where you're really trying to push yourself to basically go beyond your limits and to actually, like, hit the wall, fall down, whatever. I think, and I listened to the podcast with the rower yesterday, and rowers, oh my gosh, they are phenomenal at this. But that
Adam Creek, yeah.
Yeah, that cresting, and most of us, and that's the thing, is when you crest the difference between discomfort and pain, like you're really, you're in the well, right? Like you're doing things to your body where it's actually putting you in pain to be like, could you please stop? And that, you know, you talked about the 20%, like often when you first feel that, there's probably another 20%. Let me tell you, in Berlin, I found that 20% and I exhausted it. God.
Okay, so what happened?
You know what? I don't even know. I know.
Really? So for the people that aren't familiar with what occurred, my understanding is that you were near the end of the race, became...
No.
Oh, really?
Near the end of the race. 32.04K. I still have the Garmin file.
Oh my gosh, I'd love to see that. And you went completely anaerobic to the point that you had convulsions, or you just basically literally froze. I need to know more as your resident physiologist on this podcast. I need to know everything you can tell me about that, because that's super intense.
So we do this workout at EFT, just going back, called, it was a split 600, 200, and you get 30 seconds rest between the six and the two. And you basically do them until you fall down in the 200, like your legs don't go anymore. They crumple underneath you. And I was like running along and I was like, no, I'm going to push through this. I'm going to push through this. And my legs were like, yeah, you're going to push through this. We're going to stop. We are bending. We are crumpling underneath you. And I was basically like legs crossed, bent underneath me, sitting on them being like, ooh. And someone was like, I don't think you should stand up. And this woman comes running over and she presses stop on my Garmin. And she's like, to make sure you have the accurate data.
Which no, is why you're kidding me. Really?
No. Exactly where I stopped. But so as your resident physiologist, the next thing that happened was EMS shows up, and this lovely paramedic who spoke English was like, I'm going to hold your head in my lap and this person's going to straighten your legs. And I was like, listen, I appreciate that you're holding me, but you have my head on your lap. And when they straighten my legs, there's a good chance I'm going to vomit. He's like, thanks for the tip.
Okay.
I will roll you this way so that you don't vomit on me. I will still hold on to you. And it was indescribable pain. Like 10 out of 10, I thought my muscles were ripping off of the bone. Painful.
Oh my gosh.
And so, and I remember them putting me on the stretcher and they're like, okay, we're just going to roll you across the road. And every bump just sent convulsions through my legs where I was like, I'm going to die. Like someone's going to cut my legs off through this. And I was like, okay, now I'm getting in an ambulance with, you know, I don't know. So I end up at this hospital and I still can't really use my legs. In the very German way, they take off all my clothes.
Yeah.
Put all these electrodes on me, transferring me to the bed. I was like, I think then I actually vomited because I was like, this hurts so much. And the guy said to me, he's like, do you happen to have a phone on you? And I was like, you just took my clothes off. Like, where is the phone?
No.
Yeah. He's like, you're going to need to call someone. I was like, that's nice. I'm going to need a phone. And they really thought it was dehydration. And I was like, I'm hydrated. Like, don't pump me full of fluid. And they're like, no, like, we think you're dehydrated. And so they pumped me full of fluid, and like 30 minutes in, I was like, I have to pee.
Yeah.
And I was like, I think my legs feel kind of okay. And I stood up and immediately collapsed again. And that was the end of them letting me move around on my own. And they were like, your legs still don't work. I'm like, I'm away. I'm lying on the floor.
Yeah. I know they're not working. That's why I'm on the floor.
And I was like, but I still have to pee.
So in hindsight, what do you think went on? Do you like just push yourself purely like deeper anaerobic than you've gone? Your muscles couldn't recover. Like, what do you think happened?
You know what? I don't think I'll ever really know. I've done more running up at the cottage. Alex Hutchison alluded to this like 5 years ago, I think, when he went to run his marathon. I'm training on cottage roads up here that are about half an inch to an inch thick on top of dirt. Mm. And when you're running one of the world majors, you're running on 90 mils of asphalt on top of, you know, 24 to 36 inches of concrete. And I think it's just different.
Yeah.
And I think the pounding got to me. So I experienced this a little bit this fall. Like I came home for Rosh Hashanah and the Forbidden Five had this half marathon. And I was like, I'm going to go do your half marathon as part of my workout. And it was only 21.1K. But when I got home, I was like, oh, my legs, like I physically sore from the pounding from running on Toronto roads compared to cottage roads. And I think there's something to that. And while this is the most amazing place on earth to train, I can't ask the township to put down 36 inches of concrete on 20 kilometers of roads.
Yeah, not when you're up north. All right, it's possible because when I run on the treadmill all winter and then, you know, the weather gets nice, you go back outdoors again, you do feel very different. Like you are so sore those first few runs out on the road. So it does speak to sort of finding that surface that enables you to keep going but not injure yourself, obviously.
Yeah. And so I'm sort of done running marathons for now because running on the track is just so much more fun in my world. But I think if I trained for I'm going to do this again. I actually have a really crazy marathon plan for sometime in my master's future. All of my long runs would be on hard surfaces to like train my legs for impact.
Interesting. What's got you fascinated now? You mentioned, you know, a future master's marathon, but what do you plan? Like, what's the plan? What are you thinking about doing now? What's got your attention? What's fascinating you at the moment?
I mean, the shoes fascinate me. Like, regardless of the conversation of are they mechanical doping, like outside of that, the shoes totally fascinate me. I think it's, you know, regardless of how you feel about them, if you put your engineering hat on for a second, you go, that's a really cool piece of engineering. I've purchased most of them because this job allows me to have a bank account, which is very different for most athletes. And I have a clothing sponsor, not a shoe sponsor, so I can put whatever I want on my feet. But I desperately miss going fast on the track. So I mean, we're challenged with the COVID situation, right? Like I have a great team to train with, but you can't get on the track easily in Toronto right now. So I'm a road junkie. It's not the same. Yeah. I'm trying to make it the same, but I am so excited to get on the track again and just try and run as fast as I can in like 15, 5, 10,000. Yeah.
Tell me about the shoes. What's going on with the shoes? Just for anyone who's not fully aware of the carbon plates and how they're being designed, but from an engineering perspective, from your knowledge, how are running shoes changing? What's the controversy? What's going on with that?
So I guess there's three things. You've got the carbon fiber plate, which gives you propulsion in a sense because of the way it reacts on the ground. Nike has a permit. Huh, way to go, engineering brand. A patent. They have a patent on the shape of their carbon fiber plate. Number two is the foam that goes around the plate. And all the different companies have their own kind of secret sauce foam. Like just EVA, totally bad for the environment. Supposed to be really bouncy. And then the third thing is the stack height. And that's been the big debate with, they call it World Athletics now. And I think, I mean, stack height isn't new. Stack height's new to running. We had this conversation with stack height around alpine skiing in the early 2000s when the shaped skis came out and you put alpine skiers up on this like platform and knees were just exploding everywhere. Like not surprising, like draw the angle, see what happens. And I'm worried that that's going to happen with the shoes. I would hope that they would look to another sport to see, like if you ran with, so the newest shoe is I think 42.5 mils, the Nike Tempo Next Percent. And you can imagine on an indoor track, ripping a fast corner, what that might do to your tendons. And so it's fine if you want to go on a straight line. But if you hit a rock or if you hit an undulation in the ground, one, there's a good chance you're going to blow your ankles. And as my dad says, my shitty ankles aren't going to do well.
Yeah.
But two, if you go around a corner the wrong way, like, you know, ankle, knee, hip, back, whole body, like there's a lot around that. For sure, the combination of the stack height, the angle of the plate and the foam make you go super fast. Cool. I don't think the results that we're seeing this summer and what we've seen in the last 5 years are really any different than we've seen before. They're just faster times because they're on shoes that are making the runners run one, more efficiently, and two, faster. So you get kind of like double bang for your buck. The really cool thing, and there's studies there out there on this, is from the time they released the Nike 4%, and this is only, I think, for the Nike shoe. I can't comment on the other ones. It's so interesting. Every other shoes they've put on people, and some people are responders and some people aren't. From the 4% onward, every single person that puts that shoe on is a positive responder. The percentage that they respond varies from about 4%, but up to 12 or 13%. And because that you can't sort of regulate how much someone is going to respond, one competitor might have a 10% advantage over another. And like in the 100 meter dash alone, I mean, yeah, Usain Bolt kind of did this already, but he was never 10 meters ahead of the field. He might have been 3 or 4 meters ahead of the field, but that puts someone 10 meters ahead. Like they're crossing the line and that other person is passing the 90 meter mark. Like that's why the conversation has come around. Like, are these shoes unfair? But man, they cool. Buy yourself a pair. Go play.
Right. Go while you can. Get them while you can.
Well, and they're going to keep selling them, right? Like there's a market for them. Everybody wants to run faster and be better than their previous self. Like, awesome. Go grab those. But like, there's other things that you can do too, right? Like work on your stride, work on your fitness, work on your efficiency. You know, like it's just part of a program to get faster. It's not the be all and end all.
Sasha, I really appreciate you taking the time to hang with us. I'm sensitive to your time. So how do people get in touch with you if they wanted to ask you a question about engineering or sports or training? Like where can they find you online?
I am consistent. So I'm S Gaulish Runs across any of the platforms. So I'm not on Snapchat. I don't understand it. And I'm not on TikTok.
Okay. So we got Instagram, we got Twitter, and I got your website up here. So that's a good place to start if people want to get in touch. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time today. I'm super inspired to go out for a run. I ran just before we got on this call. But it's pouring rain. I'm not going back out now, but super inspired. So thank you for all that super cool information. I really appreciate it.
All right, everyone, I hope you enjoyed that deep dive into training physiology, into the science of human excellence. And to do that from an engineering perspective, I think was super cool with Sasha. I say things, you know, in the intro, I mentioned that Sasha, you know, was like a training geek and a nerd in that area. And I don't mean that in any sort of a disrespectful way. I totally consider myself exactly that when it comes to, you know, all of this data. So it's with love and respect that we had Sasha on the show. I'm so excited to have been able to have that conversation and to just to, you know, really think deeply about how we can all be better using the technology and data that's available to all of us these days. And I hope that you felt the same about that interview. If you did, let me know on social at Dr. Greg Wells. If you enjoyed that and you got something out of it and you think that there's other people in your network that might benefit from listening to that episode, please let them know and share it. That would be incredibly helpful to all of us. So that's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening in. We really appreciate it. And we will talk to you again really, really soon. Stay healthy and safe, everyone.